Afternoon, everyone. That's a wonderful line, isn't it, with saints of old, how saints of old still line the way. And I wasn't thinking about it particularly, but it's a nice introduction, that line, to the subject we're going to look at, because we're looking through some of the prophecies in Daniel. And if you were able to listen last week, we looked at Daniel chapter 2 and the vision that Nebuchadnezzar saw of the great image. And we saw Daniel's interpretation of that image. We're going to look this afternoon in Daniel chapter 7 at Daniel's own dream. We have to remind ourselves, I think, with all of these things, particularly when we're looking at Old Testament prophecy and other parts of the Old Testament revelation, we have to remind ourselves that we need to see these things and view these things through a new covenant lens. It's very important that we approach all of these things with the understanding that is given to us through the revelation of Jesus Christ in the New Testament. And many things are revealed in the New Testament that were not known by the patriarchs of old. It was new revelation. And we'll look at some of those things perhaps as we go through, but we know that we meet the Jewish nation in captivity as we go through the book of Daniel. Daniel is one of those captives. The nation was taken into captivity by the Babylonians under the kingship of Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar was a new king. It was only the second year of his reign when Babylon was taken captive. And among those captives was Daniel and his three friends. And although the nation itself was taken into captivity because of its rebelliousness and because of its sinfulness, because of its waywardness, nevertheless there was preserved within that nation a righteous remnant of which Daniel and his three friends are a part. And so when we read of Daniel's prophecies and we read of the things that Daniel and his friends did, we're mindful of the fact that God had preserved a remnant through whom he was going to re-establish the nation. And of course, that understanding is increased for us and enlarged for us in the New Testament. In the Old Covenant, all these things would have been seen very physically and pertaining to a physical nation, but the New Testament broadens our outlook very much so. So the nation is taken into captivity because of its failure to obey God, it's disobedience toward God, but God has preserved this remnant. And we have already seen in the dream that Nebuchadnezzar had a vision of successive empires that would follow each other, beginning with the empire of Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar himself being the golden head of the image that he saw. And we saw how each successive empire would absorb the former, so that the Medo-Persian Empire, which followed the Babylonian Empire, absorbed the Babylonian Empire into itself. And the Empire of Greece, which followed the Medo-Persian Empire, absorbed the Persian Empire into itself. And so it was true also of the Roman Empire. It has absorbed the Empire of Greece. In fact, Greek was still the language of the Roman Empire for a long, long time in many parts of the empire. And so we see these successive empires, the one following the other. And the interpretation that Daniel gave, of course, and its meaning, we looked at last time. Daniel now, however, has a dream of his own. We're going to look at that in chapter 7. Verses 1 to 14 tell us very clearly what Daniel saw in the dream. And verses 15 to 28, how the dream can be understood, the interpretation that Daniel gives. But things are changing already under Nebuchadnezzar in Babylon. Things are changing rapidly. We come to this chapter and Nebuchadnezzar is no more. Last time in chapter 2, we looked at Nebuchadnezzar's dream, and he goes to bed wondering about, you know, what's going to happen next? How will my kingship develop? You know, how long will I reign? Well, he's gone. You know, chapter 7, he's gone. And other kings have taken his place. Belshazzar is now reigning, but he's already followed his own father, Nabonidus. And so we meet the Babylonian Empire already having moved on. And as I say, Belshazzar is now reigning, following his father, Nabonidus. And verse 2 of chapter 7 tells us the first thing that Daniel sees. And he sees this enormous sea. This enormous, like a huge ocean representing humanity, tossed about by waves of changes in peoples and nations, a very choppy humanity, like represented as like a churning sea being stirred up and tossed about by four raging winds. And verse 3, we see how a succession of beasts, strange beasts, arise out of this sea of humanity, out of this churning sea of humanity. We see four beasts arising. And look at chapter verse 4 of Daniel chapter 7. The first was like a lion and had eagle's wings. I beheld till the wings thereof were plucked, and it was lifted up from the earth and made stand upon the feet of a man, on its feet, the feet of a man. Sorry, I should have brought different glasses, shouldn't I? Then we've got a larger Bible I can use. Then we've got a larger print Bible I could use. Can I borrow yours? Yeah, sorry. Yeah, sorry about that. Yeah, I was conscious that I'd taken different glasses, but that's fine. Yeah, so we're chapter verse 4 of chapter 7. So we see the first beast, which is like a lion and corresponds, of course, to the head of gold that we saw in chapter 2. And it has a man's heart, you'll notice. A man's heart, just like a sort of a heart which isn't, as other empires are, rampaging and very terrifying, terrifyingly brutal. This empire was milder than the ones that followed it. So the heart of a man pictures how Nebuchadnezzar was reached a point where he acknowledged the God of Israel and he repented, even though that repentance didn't change him very much. We see this empire is softer in many ways than the empires which followed it. So it has a man's heart. And in fact, we saw last time how the policy of Nebuchadnezzar and the Babylonian Empire under him was not to subjugate the peoples that it conquered, but rather to assimilate them into the Babylonian Empire. So that rather than subjugate people and treat them as second-class citizens, if you like, we noticed how, for example, Daniel and his friends are absorbed and used in the empire, given positions of honor, given positions of importance. And so his policy was to use people as part of the empire, as part of his empire. And make them, if you like, fellow citizens with the rest of the Babylonians. So it's a different kind of empire than the empires which followed it. And so we see that it was had the heart of a man. And then we see verse 5, a second beast which follows, a beast like a bear. Thanks, Alan. A beast like a bear, which has three ribs in its mouth. Now, these numbers are not necessarily meant to be taken literally. I think they're all symbolic. But certainly when the Medo-Persian Empire, which followed the Empire of Babylon, came on the scene, it came on the scene grabbing nations, almost creating an empire instantaneously, absorbing other empires. Egypt was one of them. Lydia was another. Babylon was another. So this beast that he sees, which is like a bear, we see how it is poised, just ready to come on the scene. And it comes on the scene quickly. And in coming on the scene, absorbs some other empires to make itself great almost instantaneously. And the three ribs in its mouth representing this fact that it comes onto the scene by grabbing empires, grabbing nations, subduing them quickly. As I say, Egypt, Lydia, Babylon was another. But these are symbolic numbers, and we shouldn't really take the numbers too literally. But it's poised to come on the scene, and it does so quickly. Then we see in verse 6 a third beast, like a leopard, faster, if you like, and more agile than the other beasts that were before it. It's like a leopard. It has four wings and four heads. And we know how the Empire of Greece very rapidly took control of the four corners of the earth. Its empire spread at enormous speed. Alexander the Great was famous for his speed of conquer. He made an empire. He was still a young man when he died. In fact, he died in Babylon after a drunken bout. But because he felt there was nothing more in life to do. He'd conquered everything. He'd done everything. He'd achieved everything. And he felt, what else can I do? What else is there in life? He'd done it all. And he had it all. And it all happened very, very speedily. That's why we have this picture of a leopard with wings to carry it swiftly and four heads showing that its empire stretched to the four corners of the earth. That's the Empire of Greece, which eventually, of course, as we know, split into four after the death of Alexander. Then, in verse 7, we find a fourth beast. After this, I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrible, and strong exceedingly, and it had great iron teeth. Of course, the reference to iron takes us to the fourth part of the image that Nebuchadnezzar saw. So it's clearly speaking of the Roman Empire, which followed Greece. It devoured and broke in pieces and stamped the residue with the feet of it. And it was diverse from all the beasts that were before it. And it had 10 horns. Here we find a beast that comes on the scene following the Empire of Greece and the Medo-Persian Empire that preceded Greece and the Babylonian Empire that preceded it. But this one is a rampaging, crushing, devastating beast. Doesn't seem to have any thought for anything but conquering and increasing its strength. It's brutal. It's merciless. And this is speaking of the Roman Empire. We need look no further than the New Testament to see how brutal and uncompromising the Roman Empire was in its doings. We think of the marvelous buildings of Rome. We think of the grandeur and the glory that was Rome. And we think of its architecture and its you know, the great things that the great wealth that it amassed and so on. But it did all of that at a cost. The rest of the world paid the cost for all those glorious things and splendorous things that were in the Roman Empire. If you were in Rome, you saw all the majesty and pomp and ceremony and riches. If you were a noble in Rome, you saw all of those things. But it was all at the expense of the rest of the world. The rest of the world paid the price for Rome's greatness and Rome's grandeur. Its wealth and its splendor were bought and paid for with a terrible price. I say, you need look no further than the New Testament to see how brutal Rome was. We find in the New Testament Rome occupying Judea. And there are crucifixions daily in many times for sometimes very menial offenses. The Romans had no mercy. When you think of the Roman Empire as a whole, it was merciless. It was brutal. And I say its wealth and its greatness was at a price. And the rest of the world paid that price. That's why this beast is represented in this very shocking and brutal way. It was uncompromising towards those peoples that it conquered. In verses 7 and 8, Daniel's attention is drawn to the 10 horns, which again is a symbolic number, referring to the multiplicity of kingdoms that were part of Rome. Remember the image of Nebuchadnezzar, the image he saw, how the feet were and the toes were of iron and clay, a mixture. There was no coherence in the Roman Empire. Everything was maintained by the rule, a brutal rule of the Roman government. So these diverse nations, diverse empires who were made to be, by brute force, part of the Roman Empire, eventually broke away into diverse kingdoms. That's what the toes represented, and that's what is spoken of here by the 10 horns. These are a multiplicity of kingdoms that make up the Roman Empire, and that eventually, when the Roman Empire is broken apart, gain their independence and sort of flow out of the Roman Empire. So we have, in the succession of beasts, we have the Babylonian Empire, which is absorbed by the Medo-Persian Empire, which is absorbed in turn by the Greek Empire, which is absorbed in turn by the Roman Empire, which then breaks up into these diverse kingdoms and nations. And then, verse 8, Daniel sees something else. His attention, the 10 horns, is only momentary, because he then sees an 11th horn appear. From among this multiplicity of nations arises an individual or a kingdom who appears to be, from the description here, almost superhuman. There's something about him which is diabolical, and he speaks blasphemous things and boasts about himself. He says things about himself that no man would dare to say about himself. He's boastful, he's proud, he's arrogant, he's blasphemous. He makes himself out to be none other than God himself. That's probably the height of his blasphemy. But he's only a man. He appears superhuman, but he's only a man. And all of our attention is focused here on this little horn. Now, if we can go to 2 Thessalonians, the Apostle Paul describes this individual in a little more detail. This is clearly referring to the individual that Paul makes mention of in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, and we read verses 1 to 9. Paul says, "Now we beseech you, brethren, by the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ and by our gathering together unto him, that you be not soon shaken in mind or be troubled, neither by spirit nor by word, nor by letter as from us, as that the day of Christ is at hand." There were people already saying to Christians that Christ has already returned, and he's over here, or he's over there, or making out that he has already appeared. His second coming has already taken place. And pretending that these revelations were apostolic in nature. Paul says, no, don't believe any of those things. They're not from us. They don't have apostolic authority. And then verse 3 says, let no man deceive you by any means, for that day shall not come, Christ will not return, except there come a falling away first, and that Son of Man be revealed, the son of perdition, who opposes and exalts himself, verse 4, above all that is called God, or that is worshipped, so that he as God sits in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God. So we have this individual who Daniel refers to as a little horn that rises up out of this multiplicity of nations that followed the Roman Empire, and is arrogant and boastful and blasphemous, and seizes power and seizes control, and gravitates nations to himself, partly out of fear, partly out of admiration, because he appears superhuman. He appears awe-inspiring. People either look up to him in fear or in admiration, and nations draw themselves to him, or they are taken by him by sheer force. And we have all the forces of evil, the whole weight of satanic power concentrated in an individual. But this is going to happen, Paul says. And Christ will not return before this happens. So it's important that we understand that. Now, what God dwells in a temple that's made with human hands? What God dwells in a temple that's made with human hands? A physical temple. What God dwells there? Well, no God at all. A God who is no God at all dwells in a physical temple. Because the God that we know, the God that we serve, has never dwelt in a physical temple and never will dwell in a physical temple. But this individual does, Paul says, in a physical building. Just remind ourselves, because we looked at this section of Acts recently, Acts chapter 17. Remember how Stephen was somewhat ahead of his time? He was preaching things and saying things that it took a while for even the Apostle Peter to come to see very clearly. Or Paul, for that matter, wasn't even on the scene then. Well, he was on the scene, but he wasn't on the scene as a Christian then. Acts chapter 17. Let's remind ourselves what Stephen says. Remember that Stephen, at the time he says this, this was something that people weren't aware of. They hadn't realized this. They hadn't known this. They thought that God had dwelt in a temple. They thought he did dwell in the temple in Jerusalem. They thought that was a reality and not just a picture. But Stephen says this, Acts chapter 17, verse 24. God that made the world and all things therein, seeing that he is Lord of heaven and earth, dwells not in temples made with hands, neither is worshipped with men's hands, as though he needed anything, seeing he gives to all life and breath and all things. Now the Shekinah glory, the glory of God, did descend on the temple in Jerusalem when it was dedicated, and it did on the tabernacle in the wilderness. But that was the glory of God mediated through angels. We read of that because the writer of the book of Hebrews makes it plain that the glory of God was mediated in the old covenant dispensation through angels. God never did dwell literally in a temple or a tabernacle. It was a picture of the place where he does dwell, but it's not here. But this man that Paul is speaking of makes for himself a temple, which he calls the temple of God, but it isn't, because he wants to present to all the world the idea that he is God, but he isn't. It's a false temple to a false God. A false temple to a false God. He sits in a temple that he calls the temple of God, or that the whole world is ready to acknowledge as the temple of God, but he is no God. And it is no dwelling place of God. God never dwelt in the temple in Jerusalem or in the tabernacle in the wilderness. It was a glory that was mediated through angels. God himself, as Stephen points out, and this was revelatory when Stephen made that statement concerning God. It was revelatory. People hadn't heard that before or understood that before. That God doesn't dwell in temples made with hands. He doesn't dwell in physical buildings. He doesn't need a house like you and I need a house. He doesn't need a physical house. The Hebrew word for the temple was, or the Hebrew phrase for the temple was Beit HaMikdash, which means holy house. But it was never a place that God actually dwelt in. It was a picture of the dwelling place of God, and no more than that. So where does God dwell? Well, notice where Daniel's focus is directed next, verse 9. Verse 9 of Daniel 7. And I beheld till the thrones were cast down. This is Daniel's vision. He sees thrones being set down. And the Ancient of Days did sit. He sees God on his throne. That's what he sees. He sees God on his throne. The Ancient of Days did sit, whose garment was white as snow, and the hair of his head like the pure wool. His throne was like the fiery flame, and his wheels as burning fire. Daniel lifts his eyes to heaven, to the dwelling place of God, to the true dwelling place of God. That's what he sees. He sees God on his throne. Now, he needs to see God on his throne because this is meant to be an encouraging message for God's people in captivity and for us now who are still in a world that is hostile towards God and becoming increasingly more and more hostile as time goes on. The tide is already turning against the church and against the Christian faith, as you know. It's already slowly turning. It will turn and turn and turn. It's not going to get any better. We're not going to become any more acceptable to this world as time goes on. Less so is the pattern that's revealed in the New Testament. So Daniel lifts his eyes to heaven, to the dwelling place of God, and he sees God on his throne. And he needs to see God on his throne because he needs to know, as we need to know, and that's the message of this prophecy, that God is in control. These successive empires follow each other. They subjugate men and nations and women. They use people for their own purposes and their own ends. And it looks like God's out of control. It looks like God's nowhere to be seen. These nations seem like they can do what they like in the world. And when an empire like Rome comes on the scene, if you were there at the time, you think that there's no stopping this empire. It seems to do whatever it likes. No stopping it. It has enormous power and it's brutal in its treatment of those that it subjugates. So Daniel sees God on his throne. Verse 10. And a court is assembled in heaven. A court is assembled. And God, acting through this heavenly court, has the power to put down any and all authority that opposes him. That's the message, that's the picture, that's the understanding that we are given, that there's a God in heaven. And one decision from that heavenly court changes things down here. You know, people think that nations rise themselves up. People think that, you know, human beings put nations down. They don't. God oversees all of these things. It's God who makes and unmakes kings. And it's decisions by this heavenly court that decide what happens down here, not people down here. Well, they're involved, and God allows them a certain freedom, and God uses them in a certain way and allows them a certain latitude. But God is in overall control, and when God decides it's time for this an empire or a kingdom to finish, it finishes by a simple decision of this court in heaven. That's the message for us, that we have confidence that God is on his throne and that he has authority to put down all that opposes him, that oppose him. This court has been sitting always. God has always been on his throne. Throughout history, it's how kings and empires are made and unmade. It's how kingdoms rise and fall. Not because they rise themselves up and someone else in this world puts them down. These things are all controlled from heaven. It's God who decides. It's God who decides. It's God who decided that Babylon would be a mighty kingdom. It's God who decided that Nebuchadnezzar would take captive the Jews, would overrun Judah. It's God who decided that. In fact, it says that he used Nebuchadnezzar to punish his people for their disobedience. It wasn't Nebuchadnezzar's idea, although he was happy to go along with it. And he may have had thoughts of subjugating Judah. But it's God who makes these things happen, causes these things to pass. Mankind thinks he controls all these events, but in reality, it's God who is in control. Verse 11, a very simple decision from this court and at an end to this little horn. I beheld then, because of the voice of the great words which the horn spoke, I beheld even till the beast was slain and his body destroyed and given to the burning flame. And as concerning the rest of the beasts, they had the dominion taken away, yet their lives were prolonged for a season and a time. One decision from that court in heaven, and this individual, who looked as if he could do anything he liked, who looked as if he had all power, could perform miracles and great signs and wonders, and people wondered after him and thought he was supernatural. When it's God's turn to put him down, he's gone. He's gone. He's taken away. Simple decision from that heavenly court. But there's something else that Daniel sees. Look at verse 13. I saw in the night visions, and behold, one like the Son of Man came with the clouds of heaven and came to the Ancient of Days, and they brought him near before him. Now, these are pictures. This is a dream. This is symbolic. It's not literal. And as we said before, there's one God, there aren't three or two. There's one God in heaven, not three. If you go to heaven, you won't see three beings. You'll see one who is God. And he is made known to us through the person of Jesus Christ of Nazareth, the Son of God, the eternal Son of God. But these things are given to us in pictures so that we can understand certain things. So we can understand that God sent his Son for our salvation. And so we are. So it's pictured here of the Son of Man, a phrase foreshadowing the incarnation, and actually the phrase that Jesus most liked to use concerning himself. It's to picture the fact that the Father sent the Son to this earth as a man for our salvation. Came to the Ancient of Days, and they brought him near before him. And there was given him dominion, verse 14, and glory and a kingdom, that all people, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion, which shall not pass away, and his kingdom that which shall not be destroyed. Just a dream, it's a picture, but it's a picture of a reality that will take place. So we've seen four successive kingdoms, four empires, four kings who have come and gone, and only the saints under Jesus Christ reign forever in an everlasting kingdom. It's not an earthly kingdom. As Jesus was keen to point out, my kingdom is not of this world, he said, but an everlasting kingdom. So we have this man who Paul calls the man of sin. We have this little horn, as Daniel represents him, who reigns for a time, times and half a time. Again, symbolic language. You can speculate on what those things mean. But what is clear is that he reigns for a time. Maybe it's like an allotted time that he was expected to reign for. And then he seems to reign for twice that time. And then it looks like he's going to go on reigning forever. Except that God cuts him short. God cuts him short. So these four beasts follow each other. The fourth beast, of course, the one that interests Daniel most, verses 19 to 22. And out of the multiplicity of nations and kingdoms that come out of that beast that succeeded the Roman Empire, emerges one who usurps authority. It's not a union. This is not a union, because he grabs power. He grabs power. He takes it by force. And then, after he's done that, others join themselves to him, partly out of fear and partly out of admiration. It's not a union of nations. It's an individual's grab for power. That's how it's depicted, both in Daniel and in Revelation. By sheer force, he snatches power. And all of the resources and power of other nations who follow him are given over to him. Verse 25. And he shall speak great words against the Most High, and shall wear out the saints of the Most High, and think to change times and laws, and they shall be given into his hand until a time and times and half a time. And of course, his time is cut short. What does all this mean for us? What does it all mean for us? Well, we shouldn't take occasions like this for granted, where we're together, we're assembled together, we're able to enjoy each other's company and fellowship as Christians, of like-minded people who believe in God, who believe in Jesus Christ, who have given their lives to him, who are one with him, who identify with him, who believe in his death on the cross for our own individual sins and for the sins of mankind, and who believe in the resurrection, believe that he's risen from the dead, believe that he's alive, and believe that he is coming again. Isn't it great that we're able to meet together and talk together and fellowship together? And it's a privilege. It's a privilege. It's a blessing that we should take for granted, because there is a time coming. That's what we've just read. There is a time coming when the church will not be visible. It won't be able to be visible, because this man, when he arrives, will drive the church down such that there's no visible church left. There'll be Christians still, but they won't be assembling together because they won't be able to. They won't even know who each other are, probably, because they'll be driven into hiding out of fear. Many will be put to death. The church will cease to be seen in the world as existing. It will look as if he's done away with the church completely. He won't have done, because God alone knows who are his, and there will be Christians left. And they'll long for these days, those Christians who are left. Maybe we won't be there. Maybe those who follow us will be there then. But whoever they are, they'll long for these times. They'll long to be together, but won't be able to be. But his time will be cut short, and Christ will return, and we all will be gathered together to meet him in the air. That's what all this means to us. The tide will turn against the church. It's turning now. It will continue to turn. And that little horn will be manifested, and he will wage war against the church. And it will seem as if the church has disappeared, as if it has no physical form in the world, although there'll still be Christians there. But at that moment, when it looks as if evil has triumphed completely, that's when Christ will return. And all the power of evil, personified in this one man, this man of sin, as Paul describes him, will be put down through a simple judgment of that heavenly court. And Jesus will return in glory. Let's close with verses 26 to 28 of Daniel 7. Verse 26. And the vision of the evening and morning which was told is true. Sorry, my apologies. That's the next chapter, isn't it? Verse 26. But the judgment shall sit, and they shall take away his dominion, to consume and to destroy it unto the end. Verse 27, and the kingdom and dominion and the greatness of the kingdom under the whole heaven shall be given to the people of the saints of the Most High, whose kingdom is an everlasting kingdom. And all dominions shall serve and obey him, that is Christ. Hitherto is the end of the matter. As for Daniel, my cogitations much troubled me, and my countenance changed in me. I bet it did. But I kept the matter in my heart. That's where we should keep this matter, in our hearts.